From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, channeling and spirit guides. And in a moment, David Politis joins us with his incredible new work, Missing 411, The Hunted. We've got the trailer up there at coasttocoastam.com. Go take a look at it. It's the first little button in the carousel reel. Unbelievable. Here's what's happening. As Dominican Republic officials try to quell rising concerns among would-be travelers worldwide about safety there, the U.S. Department of State has now confirmed the June 17th death of a New York business owner, Vittorio Caruso, a 56-year-old who died after becoming critically ill at the Boca Chica Resort in Santo Domingo. Caruso's death is now the third in a seven-day span in June, and he's the 11th American tourist to die in the Dominican Republic since last year. Something's happening over there. Iran said that U.S. cyber attacks on its military had failed. We have not confirmed that we even tried that, while also hinting that it could be willing to discuss new concessions with Washington if the United States were to lift sanctions and offer new incentives. Well, let's hope that they get to the bargaining table. Mexico has deployed almost 15,000 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, according to its country's Secretary of Defense. The deployments come after renewed pressure from the Trump administration on Mexico to help slow migration flows northward. Mexico, however, has also called on the United Nations and the United States to help with what they call a monumental task. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. John, at least 15,000 troops along the Mexican border will help on their side, huh?
Well, I think it's going to help in a very big way. I mean, you know, you're looking at Trump putting enormous pressure with those sanctions on Mexico. And, you know, Lopez Obrador, their new president, is a very peaceful, accommodating sort of president. We haven't seen that in Mexico for quite some time. Mainly, you know, Mexican presidents are, you know, have been for over the last several years, Vicente Fox and Enrique Peña, extremely antagonistic toward the U.S., and especially Vicente Fox. But I think Lopez Obrador really took seriously the commitment on their part to protect this southern border. They've sent 6,500 troops to the southern border, a total of 15,000 reservists and normal Mexican army troops are going to be conducting this operation. I don't think it solves the problem, because the problem are failed states.
Right, but it does make a dent.
It makes a huge difference, and I think you've got it shows that Mexico's doing its utmost to cooperate with Trump, and I think he'll get his free trade agreement signed, certainly with Obrador and Justin Trudeau, and so I think he's moving in the right direction.
Track John Curtis by going to his website, onlinecolumnist.com. Thanks, John. A new study has suggested a link between coffee and the activation of fat fighters in your body. Michael Siemens, a professor at the University of Nottingham and a co-director of the study, said researchers found that coffee can stimulate what's known as brown fat. Brown fat is a unique organ that is used for producing heat, and it burns fat cells quicker. How about that? Drink some coffee. Scientists have found a gigantic freshwater aquifer hidden deep below the ocean. They say that if this was discovered on the surface, it would create a lake covering some 15,000 square miles. It's a surprising discovery of fresh water in the ocean, hidden deep below the ocean. Amazing. What else is going on these days in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hi, Steve.
Hello, George. Wow, what a big night this is for many space fans. And if, of course, you live in Central Florida, just get set for the launch, the first nighttime launch that they're predicting for the SpaceX Falcon Heavy. George, if all goes well, the adjusted time, the new scheduled time, is sometime around 2:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time for an hour. And, George, wouldn't that be amazing? What a spectacular light show.
Oh, my gosh.
Totally amazing. They're going to be launching some 24 satellites. It's part of a Defense Department mission. This, again, certifies, in many ways, SpaceX to carry on with military missions. But this one, known as STP-2, Space Test Program 2. Among the interesting satellites, George, is one that Carl Sagan had a long time ago, the idea of launching a small solar sail satellite for propulsion in space. And how about this? The remains of 152 space enthusiasts, including a good and close friend of mine, astronaut Bill Pogue of Skylab fame. He was up in space for 84 days. His ashes, I should say, will be, of course, immortalized in space. But something back in the history books, George, back on this date in 1959, NASA agreed to pay for 8 Mercury Redstone rockets at the amazing then price of $20 million. That was our beginnings, of course, with the Mercury 7 to launch humans into space. George, about a few hours ago, there were 6 people in space, but now there's 3. 3 returning from the International Space Station, just landing in central Russia just hours ago on Expedition 59. But, George, as always, the listeners tell me they like this, the live sky. So, folks, if you want to see some stuff, George, here's how we end this
part. Let's do it.
We talk about Mercury. Easy to see. Look into the western sky, northwest to be precise, just after sunset. This particular planet, one of the most difficult to see, is about 23 degrees from the sun. Take advantage of it. Jupiter and Saturn, George, they dominate the early evening sky. Easy to see with telescopes. Spectacular. And the last quarter moon will adorn our morning Tuesday skies. If you have questions, we have answers. Email me at Dr. Sky. That's drskyshow@gmail.com. And, George, we say it and we love it and we mean it. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Thank you, Stephen. I always love your astronomical reports. They're the best. Up next, David Politis back with us. A two-part program tonight. For the first half, we're going to be talking about Missing 411, The Hunted, his new documentary. You can look at the trailer. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com in our carousel reel. In the second part of the program tonight with David, Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, his second edition. That's a really creepy story. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, David Politis. He's got a professional background that includes 20 years in law enforcement and a senior executive positions in the technology sector. Now, back in June of 2012, he was an invited speaker at the 2012 National Association of Search and Rescue annual conference in South Lake Tahoe. His presentation was on the findings of the Can-Am project that were detailed in his book, The Missing 411 series. And he since has films out, another book called Bigfoot Wild, which we'll talk about next hour, of course. But the film, the latest film is Missing 411, The Hunted, which we're going to talk about. And of course, there's a trailer that you can look at. It'll give you an idea of this incredible documentary at coasttocoastam.com. But let's introduce Mr. David Politis. Welcome back, David.
Hey, George, how's it going?
I'm looking forward to this. And by the way, great job on that documentary. I was riveted. You sent it to me, and I couldn't stop. I almost missed my show.
Yeah. Well, I'm humbled by your polite comments.
Now, what's new with you? What have you been doing?
Well, it's been a pretty busy year. We've been on this movie project for the last 2 years. This one was quite a bit different than the last one. In this one, we started to focus on what we thought would be an optimum storyline, and that is what people go into the woods that know the woods intimately, that are armed, and that are out there hunting and using all their senses at once. And I wrote a book called Missing 411 Hunters, and I just came out with the second edition of that book at the same time we released this movie.
Uh-huh.
And it's the second edition is much larger than the first, and it, again, focuses on hunters. And while I was out writing these stories, I ran across a series of events that hunters had had in the woods. And I started to include those stories in the books, two in particular that are in the movie that you know about. And I only included a story about hunters where there was some scientific evidence to back up the allegation that the people were making. In one incident, hunters had been encountering certain events in the Sierras for 50 years. And
jeez,
they decided that they were going to tape record in the 1970s what some of the things that they heard. And they gave that recording to a professor of audiology. And they said that in the 1970s, when they reviewed it, that it couldn't have been faked. It couldn't have been re-recorded. It wasn't a man. It was outside the scope of a human. It was too low and too high in frequency. And they went through a various set of vetting to ensure that this thing was optimum. And there was a book at the time written about it. It was so unusual. The second story had to do with a hunter that went into the woods that saw something. And during that event, a picture was taken. Well, it turns out that the photo was sent to her husband, who was the premier optical physicist in the world. And everyone probably in your show knows him, Bruce Maccabee.
Oh, sure. And, great guy.
And he analyzed the photo. He called up Verizon, asked for an analysis on the photo and the phone. And Verizon said, well, that phone couldn't have taken that photo, but the phone did take that photo. And the way the pixelation came out on the photo, it was impossible for the photo to take it. So something happened while she was witnessing this event that couldn't have happened but did, and a photo was taken that's unexplainable. So because of the scientific analysis on both cases, I included them in the movie, and it shows you some of the strange things that hunters encounter while in the woods.
And in this case, too, how many of these hunters disappear?
So in the second edition book, it's about 50% are never found, and 50% are found under highly unusual circumstances in areas that don't make sense. In a couple instances, they have no memory of what happened. It's a very perplexing scenario that's played out over my eight books, and we stay with that consistent profile point.
Those that are found, David, are they just like wandering around in a daze?
Very few are found alive. The ones that are found alive, I mean, it's less than five. They say they don't know how they disappeared. They don't know what happened. There's been some that have been interviewed that have said, you know, it's like we were walking in an area that we knew. Then all of a sudden we walked into an area that we had never seen before, never been in before, and can't explain how we even got there. And then an hour and a half, 2 hours later, they end up walking out, but if you ask them if they could walk back to the area they just came from, they said, there's no way. We've never seen that area before.
I want to jump ahead with this question because in the second half when we talk about your second edition of Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, can we make an assumption that there's a connection between that and this?
That's a funny question, George. And that leap of faith is amusing to me. And absolutely not. And
really?
The people that have read the eight books, I swear to you, this is 100% fact. I get hundreds of emails every week. I've never, ever had an email from someone that's read the eight books that said, I have this figured out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in all of these instances, 99.99% of the time, they bring a canine to the scene and they can't pick up a track or a scent.
That's strange.
They bring in professional trackers. And they can't track the person, and they can't find tracks leaving the scene.
Of the hunters that are found dead, how many of them are actually, well, let me rephrase that. Of the hunters that are presumed dead or dead, how many are found? What percent?
Oh, probably a very small percentage. I'd say 20.
And they just never find the other 80%?
Well, remember, yeah, absent the cases where the people are found.
Right, absent the other half, basically.
Right. And you got to remember that search and rescue professionals, these people are really good at finding people, and they don't like to give up. So when they don't find somebody, it's unusual. I mean, reality in search and rescues, probably 98% of the time, they find the person.
Now, Go ahead.
So in those instances where they're not found, you're talking about some of the most unusual events. And then on top of that, we kind of vet out all of the cases that don't fit this profile we work under. So if there's any evidence at all of animal predation, we don't use it. Any type of a mental illness, we don't do it. If there's evidence that the person wants to voluntarily drop out of society, we won't look at it. So there's a vetting criteria to get there. And then if it doesn't fit that profile path that we're looking for with no scent, no track, et cetera, we won't look at that either.
What percent of the hunters who disappear were out there with somebody else?
That's a great question. And the vast, vast majority of the time, they're alone. And there's a subsection of our profile points called point of separation. A lot of times, it's two hunters out in the woods. One hunter will tell the other, this happens so many times I can't count. He'll say, or she'll say, I don't feel well, I'm going back to camp. That hunter that doesn't feel well eventually disappears.
Gosh.
And it's almost as though something's forced upon that person to separate them. Somehow or another, they get sick, and nothing happens in front of two people at the same time. But something surely happens to one when they get alone.
One of the reasons that this story is so amazing, and I'm talking about the entire story that you've been covering, is because you're a former police detective. You know how to ask the questions. You know how to investigate. If this were a police case for you, how baffled would you be?
I get asked that a lot. And in a lot of ways, I feel sorry for the small rural sheriff's jurisdiction or police department that gets faced with something like this, because they're looking at it from ground level. I'm looking at these cases from 30,000 feet, meaning I look at cases from all across North America and other parts of the world, and I'm seeing the same things crop up time after time after time. But the local guy, he's probably never heard of this before and doesn't even understand why it's happening. And in the movie, there are a couple of cases where we talk to these rural sheriff's offices, and they're not rookies at search and rescue. These guys have been doing it for decades, and they are completely baffled by what happens in front of them.
And what's even stranger, David, is these hunters, unlike hikers, for example, or people who just are in the parks and they disappear, these hunters are armed. They have rifles. They have bow and arrows. Does anybody ever hear the rifle go off or anything like that?
So for the people that don't know, the distress signal, if you're a hunter or even if you're a hiker and you're lost and you need somebody to hone in on you, is you fire three rounds off.
Bang, bang, bang.
Right. Wait an hour, 2 hours, do it again. And this is another reason why I tell people to go into the woods. Don't just carry like six rounds in your gun. Carry like 18 rounds, because if you're lost, you're going to need to do this multiple times for people to find you. Now, in some hunter safety classes, they still don't teach this, and I don't know why, because everyone knows it works. Now, a lot of times, people don't hear any gunfire, and other times they hear one shot, maybe two shots, but usually if you hear three, you know where it's going, and you could find them. Now, in almost all of these instances, no, they don't hear anything. That's the peculiar part.
That's strange.
And in a couple of instances, people are found with loaded guns, and they're deceased.
Now, how are they killed, or how are they dead?
Many times, they can't determine the cause of death. In one specific instance, it baffles the coroner. They can't understand how the person died. There is no obvious sign of death. In other instances, if you don't have a body, you really don't know. But in the instance where you find the body, there's a lot of things that body can tell you, how long it's been deceased. If there's a bullet hole in the head, that's pretty obvious. If there's a broken leg, well, maybe the person broke their leg on the trail and couldn't get out. A lot of these things start to, you know, maybe tell a story that we don't quite understand. But it's in the cases where you don't find anything ever that really, I think, disturbs everyone.
And in your work and research, you found that bow hunters are a little higher up on the so-called pecking order of missing hunters.
And that's an odd scenario, because most bow hunters, I when I make talks and I talk in front of hunters and things, I always tell the bow hunters, if you go out, carry a pistol. Always carry a pistol.
Yes.
And there's a story, a great one, about a bow hunter went out being very stealthy, and he's in a pile of bushes, and he's watching this game trail looking for elk, and he hears a very, very faint sound behind him. And he slowly turns his head, and about 10 feet behind him, crouching, is this mountain lion.
Ooh.
And there's no time, and there's no way he can whip around with his bow in that small distance in those bushes and get this mountain lion. And luckily, he had a pistol. But it's those kind of scenarios where you got to be careful. Now, the weird thing about bow hunters is they have to be extremely stealthy, because they have to get very close to their prey.
That's right.
And other than that, I really couldn't tell you why so many of those disappear and are never found.
Let's talk more about this. Missing 411, The Hunted. David Politis with us back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Politis with us. Of course, we're talking about Missing 411, The Hunted. Next hour, we'll talk about Bigfoot, wild men, and giants with David. David, these hunters, are they confined just to North America, or are they all over the planet?
You know, George, it's a phenomena that we have identified in six countries, but there's probably a language barrier, and it's probably going on at many, many more locations than we understand.
And that would include other countries, then?
Absolutely.
Jeez, this is bizarre. I mean, you know, part of me, especially doing this show, thinks these guys are being abducted by extraterrestrials or something. But nobody, well, there have been cases where people have seen strange lights there, right?
So in the work I've done, there has been one or two camps that have seen orbs and things in the sky that don't make a lot of sense. Now, in relationship to that, I can, and I'm always looking, I can't find a relationship that shows a nexus between the two, which is odd, because you would think there must be, but we can't find it. But in reality, there's not. And I think that a lot of people would readily dismiss my work by saying, oh, you know what, people just disappear in the woods. There's nothing unusual about this. And that's one of the reasons we make the movies, because in this movie that we just released, we show interviews that I did with the sheriffs who actually were running the searches, and they are completely befuddled by the circumstances in front of them.
They're all baffled, aren't they?
They are. And they're not actors. These are the guys that ran the search and rescue on the searches that say, this doesn't make sense. So these aren't my words. These are the professionals doing it.
And most of these hunters are very experienced hunters, aren't they?
Some of them have been hunting the same ground for decades.
Jeez.
And that's the part that is perplexing, even to their family. And some of the stories that I've written about, they've hunted the same grounds for 40 years. The hunting camp has been in the family. There aren't a lot of places to go. There's a separation, that point of separation between the hunter, say, and a family member, and then they disappear. And then there's 2 weeks searching for them. They blow up beaver dams. They put in scuba divers. They search everywhere. Mm.
See, if a hunter fell down a hill, broke his legs, couldn't move, and he's down there shouting and screaming, but he dies there, somebody eventually is going to find that body, right?
Well, for sure somebody's going to find the gun.
Or the gun, yeah.
You know, the predation by animals may move the bones around a lot, and that'd be hard to find a specific spot. But also remember, if a hunter went down and broke his leg, he's got his gun to signal for help.
That's a good point.
Which is part of that scenario of why we focused on this. A lot of times, hiker, if they go off a trail and they break their leg, if they don't have a personal locator beacon, which I tell everyone they should be carrying, then they don't have a gun to signal for help. And so being off the trail in those circumstances may be understandable why they're not found initially. But it doesn't explain why they're never found, because a lot of people go off trail.
You know, the personal GPS locator is an absolute necessity. How many hunters carry those?
Very, very, very few.
I figured.
And therein lies the issue. And there's a segment in our movie that talks about this specific point. And whereas a hunter may spend $500, $600, $700 on their rifle and great clothing, it's that $200 device that could save your life. But you know what, George? Nobody, a hiker, hunter, nobody ever thinks it's going to happen to them.
That's the problem. So far, you've documented 31 states in the U.S. where hunters have disappeared, 9 provinces in Canada, Australia, Azerbaijan. It's happening there. It's got to be all over the place, David.
Absolutely. I mean, I've written about a series of hunters in Australia, a ton of hunters matching our profile in Canada, and like I said, the 31 other states. There's probably many, many more states that this is happening in, but we don't understand or we can't find them right now. Give me more time, I'll dig up more cases, and we'll have it. But the real overlying issue to all this is that when we go out and we talk to the families of the people that have disappeared, these people are overjoyed that anyone cares and that they're going to get some exposure and maybe something's going to happen. And after that initial 7 to 10 days when the person's gone, there's nothing else, George. The search is over. We can't find them. There's nothing suspicious in their mind. It's a done case, gone. The one thing that's come up in the last 3 years, and I've written about it because it's peculiar, is the FBI arriving on scene on some of these cases. And I think the public believes that the FBI is that all-knowing, all-interested agency that is looking for anyone who's missing, which is entirely not true. The FBI will not search for missing people. They only deal in criminal matters. Now, unless it's a small child, then there's protocol for them to become involved. But if it's a straight missing persons case, they aren't out there in the field searching because they understand that people can just fall out of society. But what's the million-dollar question is, you know how busy our FBI is with terrorism and Homeland Security. Why do two FBI agents show up in the middle of nowhere on one missing hunter case?
Great question. What are they looking for?
Nobody has that answer, including the law enforcement people at the scene. They were baffled, and it had never happened before.
And how'd they even find out about it?
Again, that's a great question. Now, in the research I've done, in the late 1960s in the Great Smoky Mountains, a couple of FBI agents started to show up on these cases of missing people. And they had a blanket statement, hey, we're here just to monitor the case. We're not here to get involved. Now, the FBI are some of the greatest people in the world for documenting incidents. And they're sitting there and they're documenting what's happening. And they write up these reports, and it goes to their behavioral analyst unit, their profilers. And what their job is to look for other cases that match what was just written about and see if there's a consistency, see if there's something going on. As I've stated in my books, I think the FBI knows something really odd is going on, but they don't know what it is.
And they don't want to guess by telling us.
They don't even want to talk about it, George.
That's a good point. The film, now, where do you get the film, Missing 411? Where do you get to watch it?
So the links are on your website, but you can get it online right now. It was just released within the last hour. You can get it on iTunes, on Vimeo, and you can get the DVD from us. It's 97 minutes long. We filmed across the United States. The director is Mike DeGrazia. He did an outstanding job. When we did the premiere Saturday night, we had some producers in from some big companies. And they said, a chorus of them said, it was the best documentary they've seen in 3 years.
That's fine. You know what? I'd concur, because I've seen a lot of them. Yeah, and this was well put together. And you even look good on film.
Well, how can that be? You see, graphics can and CGI can do a lot of things to an old guy, right?
You know, but, when you were taping the program, were you baffled by anything that just shocked you while you were putting it together?
Probably that there was validation on a couple of these cases when we talked to the victim's family, that an FBI agent did talk to him. And the victim's family asked the agent, well, what happened? You know, why are you here? What's going on? They stated, we don't know. But I think the words were, but something very unusual happened to your husband.
They're telling the family that.
Correct.
How would they even know how to say that?
Well, at this point in that one incident, the case had been going on for almost 2 weeks. They hadn't found a trace of this 80-year-old hunter. They knew he couldn't go far. They knew he was somewhat disabled. And to not find a trace, no weapon, no nothing, the agents had their backs to the wall. They didn't know anything. And again, they were just sitting there for 2 weeks monitoring what everyone else was doing, not participating, not commenting, just watching. Again, an odd scenario.
Do you think these cases go into some kind of FBI X file?
Well, I don't know what file it could go into that fits their working criteria, because there is none. That's the unusual part. But, you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And if I can validate super unusual things that are happening to hikers and hunters in the woods, I have no doubt that they are as well. And when I say that the cases that are in the movie have scientific validation behind them, well, I know that these guys are no dummies. They're super smart people. They know what's going on, but they're not going to say anything.
Have the agents also been investigating just the general hikers who have gotten lost in the parks?
Well, I only know about the cases that they're involved in when witnesses on the scene report them showing up.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, you don't know.
You don't know who they are, exactly.
You don't know. And you could Freedom of Information Act the case, and the FBI will say, nope, we don't have any files on that. And that's been a common theme the last 3 or 4 years on many of these incidents that we're looking for. There was a case out of Crater Lake where a boy disappeared about 30 years ago and was found 12 miles away in the middle of winter in an impossible scenario. And I sent him a Freedom of Information Act request for the reports. And they said, that person has a privacy right. We can't give up the reports. I sent a request back on an appeal saying the person is dead. They don't have any privacy rights. They sent a letter back and said, well, we could only find one-page report. They sent it back to me 90% redacted.
Oh,
now,
geez.
Why?
Exactly. It's like a UFO report. They scratch everything out.
Yeah, it's a very odd scenario.
Haven't some of these hunters been found in the dead of winter with no shoes on?
That's correct. And a lot of times...
That's weird.
A lot of times they were so close to camp that the opinion was is that the hypothermia couldn't have set in the time that it took them to reach the location. So hypothermia was never on the table as part of the scenario. And why would the shoes be off on this poor guy, and why couldn't they find him? And why wouldn't his feet have been torn up or rather abused to the point that it appeared that he walked over a long, lost
mm-hmm.
area? And it didn't make any sense. This has happened to hikers as well.
David, what does your detective background tell you about this, especially with the FBI involved?
Tells me that they know a lot, and they've been following this scenario for probably 35 or 40 years, because it first started, you know, way back in the late 60s, early 70s, so maybe even 50 years. They have amassed quite a file on it, no doubt. And again, if people don't know the entire circumstances of what we look at, these aren't casual disappearances. These are the most complex and unexplained scenarios that you can delve into. And I think by you watching the movie, George, you understand that the cases where they didn't find these people, there were no easy explanations.
Oh, no, it was weird. And what was even heartbreaking is the family, because they want to know what happened to their loved one.
And who do they turn to for those answers? They turn to law enforcement, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they have no answers.
They have no answers. And after that first 7 to 10 days, George, they have no help. Because when they pull out of that search, very, very rarely is anyone going back on a second and third look, because in their mind, the person's dead. It's a body recovery, and they're on to their next assignment, whatever that might be. It's a sad scenario, because there's no closure for the family. They have no answers. And many times, these disappearances occur in areas where there have been many other disappearances. I call them geographical cluster zones.
Hmm.
And we've mapped 59 of those in North America.
And one would think that the simplest explanation would be the most logical, but that's not the case in these cases.
No, there's no logic that you can apply to this that makes any sense.
No.
I mean, looking back on the profile points again, no tracks, no scent trail that canines or bloodhounds can follow. Many times, if the victim is found, they're found in an area that had been searched 15, 20 times by search and rescue, or they're found laying across a trail that search and rescue had taken out to the scene, and then they can't determine a cause of death many of the times. A lot of times, boulders are involved, and when you talk to scientists, there's certain aspects to granite that are unique and different than other topographical rocks. So that's another part of the scenario. They found inner near water, and that doesn't make sense based on the scenario that they disappeared in. Like a two-year-old child can be found 12 miles away over two mountain ranges 9 hours after they disappeared. A lot of search and rescue people are absolutely befuddled because anyone who has kids knows a two-year-old couldn't do that travel.
Can't get up there. And then sometimes the clothes is neatly tucked near them.
Weirdly, a lot of times these really small kids are found without clothes on. And search and rescue said, oh, yeah, they must have stripped their clothes. And then you interview the parents, they said, no, my kid cannot take their clothes off. They've never taken their clothes off in their life. So how did the clothes come off?
Yeah. Now, one would think some sicko was out there, but that's probably not the case.
There's too many times this has happened. And, again, they're found in remote areas where there's no tracks around them, in remote areas where there's no vehicular access. There's no way to move that person efficiently and easily. Now, maybe you or I could carry a two-year-old a couple of miles through the woods without an issue. But when you talk about people weighing 150, 200 pounds, there's very few individuals out there that could carry that weight miles through the mountains.
Right.
It's just not going to happen.
200 feet would be lucky for me. Jeez.
Yeah, exactly.
Of the bodies that are found, do they autopsy them?
Yes, they do. And the issue with that is that some states release those and are public record. Other states don't release them and they aren't public record. And unless the family, and you can find the family, is willing to release those records to you, you don't know what happened.
And you can't get it unless somebody from the inside talks, and they probably won't.
Right.
David, we're going to take a quick break, then we're going to come back and talk about Bigfoot, wild men, and giants. It's just, I got to tell you, you know, for the years I've been talking to you about this, I just keep shaking my head. It's just... How do you sleep knowing that there's something as weird as this out there?
You know, George, it's not so much not sleeping. It's worrying about the families that you get a relationship with.
And you do.
Yeah.
And you do. And they'll never get their answer, at least not for a while.
But hopefully one of these psychics, one of these days you're going to have on your show, is going to hit on something. But I haven't found one that has.
Not yet. But you're right, we might get close. David, let's talk about Bigfoot, wild men, and giants next on Coast to Coast AM.